Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org, and by Cargill, collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Of all the things we could have imagined telling you about today, the biggest stock offering ever in this country was certainly not among them. Maybe the gang running Visa knows something we don't, because they are betting $19 billion on it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working to help reduce greenhouse gases with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Monday. It's the 25th of February today. The smart money would seem to be saying run. Run far and run fast. But then again, it's not like the stock market's ever made sense, did they? Visa walked right up to Wall Street today and introduced itself as if we were in the middle of a raging bull market. The world's biggest credit card network has filed for a blockbuster initial public offering, almost double the previous record. Our New York Bureau Chief Joe Barshay explains why Visa's riding high.
This IPO will change the shape of Visa. Right now, Visa is owned by thousands of banks collectively. Mark Sacher specializes in credit cards at Oriema Consulting Group. He says after the IPO, Visa will be mostly owned by investors who buy shares.
Previously, their directive was not really to make a profit, but rather to serve the interests of their members. Now going forward, they are going to be a for-profit company.
Sacher says the credit crunch isn't hurting Visa. It's the member banks who have to worry if you pay your bill or not. Visa's money comes from the fees it gets every time you buy something with the card.
We continue to, as a society, move toward electronic payments. And because Visa, in particular, has such great positioning in that space, I think any time is a good time for them to go to market.
MasterCard held an IPO in 2006. Since then, its stock has quadrupled. Rich Melville is the managing editor at American Banker. He says credit card companies are facing billions of dollars in lawsuits from retailers over transaction fees. The banks that own Visa want to transfer that responsibility to the public.
The banks are then distanced from litigation risk. If Visa loses the lawsuit from the retailers, the banks don't have to pay out of their own money. It's Visa's headache.
Some of the $19 billion will go to pay off the retailers. Another big chunk will help shore up the member banks' balance sheets. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
The way these things work, it's probably already too late for regular Joes to get in on the action, but look for Visa to start trading March 20th under the ticker symbol V. The Democratic presidential candidates are gearing up for their next debate tomorrow in Cleveland. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton have been going back and forth about who'd run the economy better. One of the hot issues is infrastructure. Each candidate has a proposal to shore up public works, but private businesses are also seeing opportunity, as Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Private equity groups are paying a lot of attention to planes, trains, and automobiles these days. Companies like the Carlyle Group are setting up special funds to invest in infrastructure. Foreign sovereign wealth funds like the idea as well. Richard Gritta is a professor of finance and transportation at the University of Portland. He says it's not surprising.
A lot of private equity was heavily invested in the mortgage industry, and having been burnt there, they're looking for better places to recycle their money that are safer.
But some groups think what's safe for private equity will make taxpayers sorry. The powerful Service Employees International Union wants state pension funds to invest in public projects. Andy Stern is president of the SEIU. He says it's crucial to keep our airports, roads, and bridges out of the hands of these funds.
They have one purpose, to make money. And the only way they can make money is to raise fees and take out all the profits.
Stern says public ownership also means our country's infrastructure won't end up in foreign hands. Randall O'Toole of the Cato Institute says private ownership of roads and bridges is popular in countries like France.
A private company will build a bridge or a highway and toll it, and after so many years, they turn the facility over to the government. It does not cost taxpayers anything, and it works very well.
There will be plenty of business to go around. The government reckons sprucing up this country's crumbling infrastructure will cost about $225 billion a year for the next 50 years. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
With all apologies to Las Vegas, it's probably more true to say that what happens in Liechtenstein does actually stay in Liechtenstein. Or at least it used to. Strict bank secrecy laws have helped make the landlocked European principality a tax haven. But a secret list of account holders at one bank there has been sold to tax officials in at least two European countries. And Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports now from Washington. The list is getting some attention here as well.
A former employee of Liechtenstein's LGT Bank stole a list of their customers, and then Heinrich Kieber sold the list of German account holders to that country's foreign intelligence agency, reportedly for more than $6 million. Last week, German tax authorities conducted dozens of raids on the homes and offices of possible tax evaders on the list. As a result, the German Treasury is likely to recover more than $650 million in lost taxes. Germany's success prompted British tax authorities to pay some $200,000 for information on the 100 or so wealthy Brits on the list. Now, France, Finland, Canada, and the United States all want to know whether any of their citizens are on Kieber's list. He's now hiding in Australia. Ted Truman, the co-author of Chasing Dirty Money, says this will raise the pressure on tax havens to start sharing more banking information.
The very fact that this has sort of uncovered this practice, which was not a surprise to anybody, may actually be very helpful all the way around in loosening up the tax havens and tightening up the regulation and exchange of information.
The IRS declined comment on reports the U.S. has paid for the list of American customers on the Liechtenstein Bank, but Michigan Senator Carl Levin says he intends to investigate the small country's banking practices. His subcommittee estimates the U.S. Treasury loses as much as $100 billion a year in offshore tax evasion. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Bond insurers brought sunshine to Wall Street. We've told you how they and their AAA ratings have been sullied by the subprime mess. Standard & Poor's said today it's sticking with its high ratings for both MBIA and AMBAC. That'll do something, anyway, to ease worries the credit squeeze is going to get worse. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Minneapolis Grain Exchange doesn't get a whole lot of press, but we mention it today because of wheat prices. They trade high-protein spring wheat there. It shot up more than 20% today. Good old-fashioned winter wheat's not booming quite that much, but even it has been dabbling in record territory. Rising agricultural commodities like that are making food overall more expensive. It's bad enough for us when we run to the grocery store. It's potentially disastrous for international food assistance programs. Bob Bell's with the relief group CARE. Mr. Bell, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
What does this mean for your group, for the way you do business?
The mechanisms for us are that we generally get food primarily from the United States government. And if the costs of food keep going up, then that's obviously going to have an effect on just how much food we can make available and how many people we can cover in a program.
Is there also an effect as these prices rise on government subsidies in countries where those subsidies are needed?
It certainly may have an effect where you've got different governments are going to have to figure out different ways how they can provide support for different parts of the population to assure that more food is available to those people. Because the fact is that not only are there issues around cost of food here in the United States related to food aid, but the other side of it, CARE's got a great concern that, you know, we're seeing rising food prices in actually developing countries. So, yeah, it's a problem, and they're going to have to figure out how they're going to deal with that.
Well, what do you do if those prices don't stabilize sometime soon?
That's the magic question. And the question becomes, what does soon mean? If you're looking out over the next year, it seems to me that one of the things that we certainly are going to be more interested in is what kind of support is going to be available for emergency assistance, or what kinds of support is going to be available for what we would call safety net programs. And that is, for example, making sure that people have food if that resource is appropriate, so they don't fall down deeper into a hole.
Is there a chance that you might have to say one day, we haven't got it, we haven't got the food to give?
Is there a chance? I suppose yes. On the other hand, I don't think that CARE believes that we will arrive at that point. What our big interest is how do we figure out ways to make more food available? So that is why, for example, CARE very much supports the idea of being able to purchase food locally and regionally on a much greater scale than we do now. We think that we're moving in those directions, so I don't think I would be prepared to say that we'll reach a point where there just isn't enough food for people.
Of course, this is a bad time for you to be getting into the business of buying food with rising prices, right?
It's an absolutely bad time. It's an issue that we've faced over probably 50 years. CARE is an organization that has received food aid primarily through the United States government over the years, and there obviously have been times in the past where prices have gone much higher. I think the difference for us this time around is that we are focusing more on what are the kinds of things that we might be able to do in countries, working in alliances with the WFP or other organizations and with governments in trying to deal with this issue of inflation. I can't say that CARE would have all the answers around that, but I think we see there needs to be a collective effort to try and get at it. It is very much of a problem.
Bob Bell is the director of CARE's Food Resources Coordination Team. We reached him down in Atlanta. Mr. Bell, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
San Francisco is the place to be this week if you're the type who enjoys discussing greenhouse gas emissions policy. A group called Carbon Forum America is holding its annual conference there. More than 1,000 people talking about carbon regulation. The energy bill that passed in December took a step in that direction. It included a plan to phase out the sale of incandescent bulbs. You're not going to find super efficient light emitting diodes in grocery store aisles just yet, but those swirly compact fluorescents are pretty much everywhere. That doesn't mean people want to buy them, though. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Joellen Easton reports.
Scott Case's job is showing companies how to reduce waste and save energy without losing money. So it makes sense that he'd use compact fluorescent light bulbs in his own home. But there's just one problem.
When you turn on the light switch, they warm up kind of slowly before they get bright.
And his wife, Victoria Williams, she hates that. She's a professor at a nearby college and is most definitely not an environmentalist.
I like to walk into a room, flip the light switch, and have it instantly as bright as I want it to be.
Case uses all sorts of techniques in his battle with wife Victoria to get CFLs into the house. He tries to find ones that look like incandescent bulbs. He puts them in hard-to-reach fixtures. He mixes them up with the regular bulbs so any difference in light is subtle.
Victoria has for many years said, well, you know, when I'm buying all this stuff, you've won.
And plenty of other people are buying CFLs. The energy-saving bulbs made up 20% of the U.S. light bulb market in 2007, and sales, they're doubling annually. Noah Horowitz is a senior scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council. He says CFLs have come a long way in the last 10 years.
When you flick the switch, there'd be a delay and a blink, 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 and you might have looked like a Martian underneath because of the light quality. Today's CFLs are much, much better as they're much smaller. They come in the spiral or curlicue shape. They'll fit in a lot more sockets. They turn on instantly and give very good light quality.
But there's just no getting over that slow warm-up period that Victoria Williams hates so much. Horowitz hopes consumers will look past that to the environmental and cost savings and the bulb's non-energy benefits, their reduced maintenance and longer life. Jorge Fernandez is the light bulb merchant at Home Depot. He picks the bulbs the store carries, and he's working with Home Depot's vendors to develop a smarter CFL. He says a new bulb set to launch this year could warm up twice as fast as existing compact fluorescents.
It's a brand new design, and it adds a layer of intelligence to the light bulb that will enable it to have an instant-on feature and a faster warm-up time that will then gradually decrease to the light efficiency and the energy efficiency that people are talking about.
But it'll be some time before consumers can put these intelligent bulbs in the lamp next to their reading chair. The first generation of the new technology is designed for specialized settings, like security lights. Fernandez says manufacturers are rushing to meet consumer needs. They're designing compact fluorescent bulbs that can dim properly, and they're making them in a range of styles and light intensities.
It really is all about making this as much like the light bulbs that people grew up with as possible.
Skeptical consumers like Victoria Williams aren't easy to persuade. They want a more environmentally friendly product, sure, but they don't want to compromise. But if CFL makers really can make the new bulbs look and behave like their incandescent cousins, then maybe skeptics like Victoria will warm up to them. Eventually. I'm Joellen Easton for Marketplace.
Coming up, fewer ads on French TV.
Is it a good idea, do you think, to get rid of advertising on public television in France?
Well, it could be if it was not this government.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 1.5% today, 189 points to close at 12,570. The NASDAQ rose 1%, 24 points, closed at 2327. The S&P 500 picked up 1.3%, that is 18 points. Ended the day there at 1371. Investors rewarded Ambac and MBIA for that good ratings news we mentioned. Ambac shares jumped more than 15%. MBIA picked up almost 20%. It was a picture-perfect day for Getty Images. Shares in the stock photo giant rocketed nearly 30% on news that the private equity firm Hellman and Friedman will acquire the company. Markets overseas finished sharply higher. Back home, bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.89%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. The song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Tuesday. In New York, the Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. A House committee holds a hearing they're calling Cracked Justice, addressing the unfairness in cocaine sentencing. And the National Low-Income Housing Coalition concludes its policy conference and lobby day. Topics covered include national disaster housing strategy and ex-offenders' access to housing. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is still dealing with its own post-Katrina emergency. FEMA has announced it's going to do some more testing on those trailers that hurricane evacuees have been living in. There are thousands of them all along the Gulf Coast. Tests have shown dangerous levels of the possible carcinogen formaldehyde in them. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports it's not just FEMA campers and trailers that have problems.
FEMA is hoping to move everybody out of the trailers by June 1st. In the meantime, it announced that people can ask for formaldehyde tests. More than 300 people have requested tests so far. FEMA spokesman James McIntyre says the agency will move people into hotels or apartments for 6 months if they want to leave their trailers. But McIntyre stresses that FEMA had no way of knowing that formaldehyde levels in the trailers would make people sick.
We bought units from the industry that they built according to the standards that they build them off. So even if you bought one off of a commercial lot, it will still be built with materials that use formaldehyde.
But travel trailers weren't meant to be lived in. It's not clear that formaldehyde would cause health problems after a short camping trip. But the Katrina evacuees who've been living in the trailers tell horror stories. Attorney David Krangel is representing residents who filed a lawsuit.
We have people who have aggravated an existing asthma condition, developing asthma, you know, these terrible respiratory problems, skin rashes.
Sierra Club spokesman Oliver Bernstein says what's really needed is a new federal standard for indoor air quality.
We don't want to use people as human test kits. We would much rather the government ensure that all emergency housing is safe.
The Recreational Vehicle Industry Association represents trailer manufacturers. The organization didn't respond to Marketplace's interview requests, but a spokesman told MSNBC that manufacturers use low-emitting materials to keep formaldehyde at a safe level. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Clearly, undervalued is the word that companies use when they don't like a takeover bid. It's what Yahoo said about Microsoft's offer. They're still saying it, in fact. And it's what video game publisher Take-Two Interactive said today about a $2 billion query from Electronic Arts. The timing is important here. Take-Two is set to release the latest version of its juggernaut Grand Theft Auto franchise in a couple of weeks. So maybe it's holding out for more cash on the barrelhead. Management guru Charles Handy wonders why American companies are so concerned with size in the first place.
Americans think big. This has helped make them the most powerful nation on Earth. But bigger is not always better, either for our bodies or, I suggest, for our organizations. If I were to visit a symphony orchestra and ask them about their growth plans for the future, how would they respond? They would talk about their plans to extend their repertoire and to bring their work to new audiences, not about increasing the number of violinists. The same holds true for a school or a hospital. Once they get to the appropriate size, they strive to be better, not bigger. Why should it be different for business? Why does almost every business that I know seek to grow in size, year after year, in fact, as if there were no limit? Why can't they be content with doing more with less? I ask because large organizations are not usually, or even often, nice places in which to spend the best part of our lives. Humans are most comfortable in clusters of 10 to 12, family-sized groups. Put them in armies of hundreds and thousands, and they cease to be individuals, but only human resources, just numbers in jobs. Humanity too easily yields place to bureaucracy. An executive in the project I am working on at the Drucker School in Claremont, California, calls the business he created a bonsai organization, after those small Japanese trees. These trees need to be trimmed and reshaped, but they don't grow beyond their ordained size. So it is, he says, with his organization. And if you really have to be bigger, then maybe the challenge is to create woods of bonsai trees. This way, the economies of scale and the personal ambitions of our leaders won't run up against the constraints of human nature. Because if we aren't careful, organizations can become the prisons for our souls.
Charles Handy is a visiting scholar at the Drucker School of Management and the Drucker Institute at Claremont Graduate University. His latest book is called Myself and Other More Important Matters. Tell us what you think. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Contact. The French are known for their willingness to take to the barricades in defense of their cause. Late last year, it was a nationwide transit strike over changes to public pension plans. Last week, it was strikes to protest a plan to ban commercials on public television. President Nicolas Sarkozy says he wants to improve public broadcasting, create a sort of French BBC. But why might people want commercials on public television? Here's John Laurenson from Paris.
When you flip from France's main private TV channel TF1 to its main public competitor, France 2, you should be able to tell the difference. There's no reality TV on the public channel, more dramas. But there's one time you definitely can't tell them apart.
Ça bouge dans le monde de la vaisselle.
Commercial breaks. French viewers pay $150 a year for a license to watch public television. During the 20 minutes of ads that France 2 broadcasts between the 8 o'clock news and the main evening feature, they may well wonder why.
Les programmes sont de toute façon dépendants de
Olivier Millot covers television for entertainment magazine Télérama. He says French public TV viewers are getting the worst of both worlds. They have to sit through hours of ads and pay the license fee. Worse still, to get those advertising dollars, the mainstream public channels have to chase ratings just as the private channels do. But that's about to end. Sarkozy recently set up a commission to decide how best to do away with advertising on public channels. Mathieu Gallet, TV advisor to the Minister of Culture, says that under Sarkozy's plan, French public television will be able to rival the high quality of the BBC. The British broadcaster doesn't have ads on its domestic broadcasts.
I think that's a good opportunity for the French TV in France to take more risks on new programs, new formats, working with new producers, leaving the time to the new programs to find their audiences.
The move is expected to cost public broadcasters $1.8 billion in lost advertising and new programming. Labour unions fear the government will fail to honour its promise to provide that money and maintain public broadcasting. Earlier this month, they staged the biggest strike French broadcasting has seen in 30 years. The unions also don't like that much of the lost advertising will land at the private channels, the biggest of which is owned by the billionaire Martin Bouygues, a close friend of Sarkozy's. And there's a good deal of scepticism on the streets of Paris.
Is it a good idea, do you think, to get rid of advertising on public television in France?
Well, it could be if it was not this government.
You suspect the motives of Mr. Sarkozy?
Yeah. I think he's going to give the publicity market to his friends from the other private channels.
The government says it's still figuring out how it's going to pay for the reform, maybe new taxes on TV advertising revenues and or the profits of internet and phone service providers, a growing medium for television. Taxes would, of course, hit the private channels, but they expect the increase in ad revenues will more than balance that out. Whatever happens, the deadline's coming up fast. Sarkozy wants his new commercial-free TV up and running this time next year. In Paris, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Pandemic flu is a real threat, but there are steps you can take to prepare. More information at takethelead.pandemicflu.gov. By Medtronic, celebrating National Heart Month by encouraging women to reduce their risk of heart disease. More at goredforwomen.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, we closed on Friday last week, if you remember, with a ski report of sorts. The troubled mortgage lender Countrywide had organized a jaunt to Vail for some partners, complete with posh stays at the Ritz and dinner reservations at Spago. Yeah, it got canceled. Seems the company's decision to hit the slopes while many of its customers hit the skids struck observers as tacky. Senator Charles Schumer, Democrat of New York, called it shameful. Nothing turns a ski trip into a big bummer, I suppose, like a little bad publicity. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 189 points, 1.5%. The Nasdaq jumped 24 points, 1%. The S&P 500 shimmied up 18 points. That is 1.33%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, money is slim, but the demand is high for doctors in Israel.
Whereas a generation ago, Jewish mothers would really beseech their children to go to medical school, now they tell them to have a startup company.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.